on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Road Warriors, better believe it, both of the CSs sit at 2-0 with the visiting team in command of the series. Mariners headed home up 2-0. We will review game two of that series and preview game three. And out in Milwaukee, the Dodgers took care of business and then some, taking game one and game two at American Family Field. We'll chat about those, including one of the weirdest plays we've seen in the playoffs for some time. And we'll finish up by chatting about the managerial carousel. Buckle up, folks. It's Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world unimpressed with Yoshinobu Yamamoto's complete game. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we have watched like all of these games in their completion. I've finished these.
Yeah, that's so true. We're there at the beginning and we're there at the end. I don't know why we have to celebrate this guy on this podcast, but you know what? I think we will, because I didn't wake up here at 6 a.m. on the West Coast here in Seattle, Washington, to just poo-poo the great achievements of these here ball players in the Major League Baseball postseason. Good morning, my dear friend Jake Mintz. It is good to see you. I'm excited to talk about the Dodgers, excited to talk about the Mariners, excited to talk about the baseball, because that
Not
is our
excited
job.
To talk about the Brewers.
I'm excited to talk about their first swing of the game. We have a lot to get to, Jake, and I have a long day ahead of me. So let's get into it. It's our opener.
Brilliance, dominance from Yoshinobu Yamamoto last night at American Family Field in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 9 innings. You heard that right, your friends. 9 innings, 3 hits, 1 run. It was very earned. 7 strikeouts in one of the more memorable postseason pitching performances we have had in quite a long time. Jackson Churio goes yard on the very first pitch Yamamoto sees to put the Brewers up 1-0 in the bottom of the first. And then that's it. That's all anybody wrote. Dodgers score 5 runs, get a homer from Teoscar, you get a homer from Max Muncy, and the Los Angelinos stampede to a 5-1 victory over the Brewers to take a commanding 2-0 lead in this series. We have not recorded since game one, which was, I would say, pretty similar, except the Dodgers scored fewer runs, and thus it was much wonkier. But let's just begin with Yamamoto, I think, and we can work our way back. Because what he did last night really legitimately was singular in this era of baseball.
Yes, first postseason complete game since Justin Verlander in 2017. First one
Ben's
by a Dodger since 2004. Yes, famously known as Ben's older brother. JV went 124 pitches in that game. I vaguely remember this game. This was ALCS game 2 against the Yankees. And wild thing about that game is that the game was tied. And so he went 9 at home. And then they sent him back out there in a 1-1 game. I assume already over 100 pitches. He had like 13 strikeouts. And then the Astros ended up walking it off. At the earliest parts of the Astros.
All the neutrals were like, this is sick. Like, they're beating the Yankees. Dude, I love this.
I bring this up all the time. Like, it is very funny to think about how we talked about the Astros in 15 and 17. Like, they were a team that a lot of people were just like endeared by.
It was tiny. He still is.
Anyway, so that is why this is significant, because we've been having these conversations, even as we've seen some amazing pitching performances, even this month, we're always like, well, but, you know, complete game's probably never going to happen again. Maybe not that dramatically, but it was like, well, what would it take? What circumstance would be required
And the answer to that game is Dodgers bullpen existing. Right.
Yes.
If you are Tarek Skubal, a complete game is less likely because Tigers manager AJ Hinch has faith in Kyle Finnegan for some reason and Will Vest for good reason. That is not the case with the Dodgers, where it is Roky Sasaki who threw quite a bit in game one. Sometimes Blake Treinen, sometimes Alec Vesia, and then, you know, crossing your fingers and hoping for the best. The question when you decide to leave someone in, leave a starter in and let them work deep, is the next pitch that this starter is going to throw going to be more effective than what I could get from my bullpen, right? We talk about this a lot in small school baseball, Schrodinger's reliever. Until the reliever exits the bullpen, it's alive, right? But the second it gets out on the mound, anything can happen. And last night, it was pretty clear and obvious that Yamamoto was the best option as the game wore on for the Dodgers.
Yeah, and so I did not watch this live because I was flying to Seattle and we didn't have Wi-Fi. So I had kind of an interesting experience with this because I saw the Churio homer as we were taking off. And I was like, oh, man, okay. And remember, Yamamoto didn't make it out of the first inning against the Brewers in the regular season and also was not awesome against the Phillies. He was okay, right? And so because of that, it was like, all right, Brewers, maybe you got something. Then, you know, I'm in the air, I'm flying across South Dakota, and I'm thinking, okay, Brewers, are the Brewers gonna make this interesting? And then I land, and I pull up the box score. And not only do I see Dodgers 5-1, I was like, okay, like that part when I just saw Dodgers 5-1, I was like, all right, that's fine. When I opened Dodgers and saw a complete game, I was like, excuse me?
The best part, by the way, Brewers rolling out six pitchers versus the Dodgers one makes the actual physical box score look so beautiful because there really is nothing like going to the bottom of a page where the pitcher's part of the box score is and just seeing one line, one name.
Yeah. Right. And we just don't. Oh. This doesn't happen this time of year. Now, I will say, going back and watching this, what stood out to me about his performance. And I've just gushed over Yamamoto since he got here. I mean, he is, when he is locked in, he is as good as it gets, as smooth as it gets, as in command in every sense of really four plus pitches. But now the Dodgers had a 5-1 lead by the end, right? But even still in a postseason game, you know, you might not think that they let him go out there and face the middle of the Brewers order for, I guess, a fourth time, right? By the end of the game. And Dave Roberts was like, yeah, this is obviously our best option. Now, as we kind of go a little bit more backwards, the night before certainly helped to inform that decision, indisputably. Not just the last few weeks, but literally what had happened 24 hours earlier.
I mean, if you look at what I'm compelled by, you look at Yamamoto's pitch selection last night, fascinating stuff. So he throws 31% splitters, 24% curveballs and 24% fastballs. When was the last time that a starter in the playoffs threw as many curveballs as four-seam fastballs? The answer is probably Lance McCullers at some point. But you just don't, like, curveballs as a pitch.
Not cool anymore.
Have decreased in efficacy and popularity over the last 10 years because it is the slowest of the pitches, right? And it is a pretty simple equation. The slower the pitch, the more time the batter has to react to the pitch, the less effective the pitch is going to be. I'm oversimplifying it, but that is just kind of part of the reason why curveballs have declined in usage. Yamamoto doesn't care because his is so freaking good, and he could just reach back and, you know, pump it 95. Last night he averaged 96.3 on his heater. This was with a ton of carry and ride from a, you know, low slot. This is as good as pitching gets, man. Like, this was awesome. I too was on a plane, woke up early this morning, watched it all back, and it's just what dominance looked like. Now, I don't want to take anything away from him. Brewers offense, not good. The concern all year is that this offense did not have the juice to compete in October. And that is very much looking like the case. Churio, as the character who could, like, he felt like a player that could hit good pitching, right? That he could, is talented enough to be elite against the elite. The rest of this Brewers lineup, it was like, okay, are we, do we really think that like Joey Ortiz and Andrew Vaughn are going to be able to do this when the lights get bright and the pitching gets really, really good? The answer in the last round was yes, enough. This is a different level though. What the Dodgers have done through the first two games, particularly, well, not particularly, with their starting pitchers is a whole other world. So let's actually pivot back down to game one. You want to handle that recap?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it was pretty similar in that the Dodgers starter was amazing. And it's funny to think that Blake Snell, who went eight innings, allowed one total base runner, maybe two, but
one hit,
no walks, 10 strikeouts, that he would get one up 24 hours later. But this was certainly one of Blake Snell's best career starts. And, you know, Freddie Freeman hits a homer off Chad Patrick early, but it's a very, very close game. And the Brewers pitchers are keeping it close, and credit to them. We get to top nine and
Dodgers start. We have to talk about the play.
Yeah. You know, I realized that I didn't have this on here and that was a mistake. But it was also like, this is the perfect example of like a play that is so preposterous and also didn't end up really mattering, to where I'm just, it like gives me a headache to try and talk about.
Especially in audio.
Yes, this was, yeah.
I will do this. I will shoulder the load here. Bases loaded, one out, I believe. I want to say it was in the fifth inning. I was in the Mariners clubhouse after they won game two while this play happened, and like watching a bunch of baseball players watch this play is something that I will legitimately never forget. Top of the fourth, bases loaded. Max Muncy clobbers one to center field. Sal Frelick playing center field, ranges back, leaps, brings it back, can't hold on, ball pops out of his glove, doinks against the top of the fence, and then lands in his mitt. It is unclear in real time if he catches it or not, and all you know is that the ball is in his glove and he's like doing baseball activities with the ball and it's not over the fence. He throws it in to the cutoff man, who I believe was Joey Ortiz, the Brewers shortstop. Joey Ortiz then turns and fires towards home plate, where Teoscar Hernandez is a half second late sliding into home. And you're like, what did I just watch? And as you're about to try and wrangle what you saw, William Contreras just starts jogging towards third base, which is not something a catcher does too often. The camera cuts back to Sal Frelick, who is perplexed. The main participant in this play looked more perplexed than anybody else, right? Which only added to the element of confusion. So here's what ends up happening, right? This is effectively a ground ball. Now, I know that is the silliest thing in the world, a ground ball that literally never hit the ground, right? It just hit the fence. But think of this like a ground ball with a force out at home. Now, because the Dodger runners thought this ball was going to be caught, they tagged up. And when they tagged up, they gave Frelick the opportunity to throw home. After the fact, I believe before game two, Teoscar Hernandez said, basically, I effed that play up, right? Which happens sometimes. But the visual was outrageously bizarre. And then what happens is Contreras jogs towards third to get the force out of the runner that never ran to third, right? So it is just a double play with two force outs made by the same person who happens to be the catcher. Now, Dave Roberts then challenges the play, arguing that the what happened was not made clear enough to the runners in the moment, and that is why they acted the way they did. And maybe there's some legitimacy to that, but my response would be, no, this is just too silly and wonky. And like, what do you want the umps to do? Understand exactly what's happening in the moment? Sal Frelick didn't know what was going on. Okay. He's out there.
Yeah.
So this was a play. Yeah. You're right. This did not matter in the end. I guess it kind of does, because if this play like is a home run, the Dodgers bullpen doesn't get a chance to look bad in the ninth, really, or they have more leeway.
Not in the same way. Yeah, that's fair.
Right.
Sure.
But at the same time, this is the single most memorable, second most memorable play of this postseason so far. Maybe I'm going to keep backtracking.
I mean, yeah, it was certainly as unique as it gets.
It's Polanco's hit, it's Kirkering yeeting it away, and it's this. So far in my head, yeah. Right?
Sure.
And I think that in and of itself deserves some joy, because, like, you know, I guarantee you my father-in-law, when I see him in a couple days, is going to be like, I was scrolling on online and I saw this. What happened? Like, I'm going to have to explain this one. And so thank you for giving me the window to do it here on the podcast first.
No, I mean, I can't dispute that it was one of the most ridiculous plays I've ever seen. And yes, a 400-foot GIDP is pretty hilarious. So, but to that point, because the Brewers got out of that in inexplicable fashion, the game does remain quite close until the top of the ninth, where Dodgers have some traffic and they got second and third with, I think, only one out. And Abner Uribe, well, I guess Pat Murphy, decides to intentionally walk Shohei Ohtani to load the bases on purpose for Mookie Betts, which literally just happened in the series before. And we saw Yoan Duran, who, again, Yoan Duran, that dude throws strikes. That's a closer that you're not expecting. I think he had never walked in a run in his career. So it's like you trust him to throw strikes in that situation, even facing a guy like Mookie. We saw what happened in that scenario where Mookie had an amazing at-bat and drove in around the walk. Abner Uribe, I love him. One of my favorite relievers. But that's a guy that's going to lose the zone. And you're really, really asking for trouble in this situation. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens.
Shohei stinks right now. Just pitch to the bum.
Sure. Sure. So both of those things are making this move feel not the best. And ultimately, this is incredibly important, because run that the Dodgers score gives Roky Sasaki and Blake Treinen enough cushion to not blow the game. Because this was the first time that we saw Roky Sasaki not look completely otherworldly, really, in the last 3 weeks. He gives up a ground rule double to Jake Bowers. His command is not good. His velocity is down. He's like only throwing 97, 98. Which, again, is a big difference. Like, this is part of what has made... I mean, clearly he's throwing more strikes and he's more confident, but there is a big difference between Roky throwing 97 and Roky throwing 100 because of the shape of the fastball. And that was clear. And so that, I think, how Roky looked alone, it's not like Dave Roberts was ecstatic to go to Blake Treinen, but how Roky looked made him make a move. We bring in Blake Treinen, and then we have a situation where Bryce Terang, very understandably, but also maddeningly, does not get out of the way, does get out of the way, I should say, of a sweeper inside, which would have been a hit by pitch that would have scored a run. And instead, he ends up striking out, and it bases loaded. Instead, he ends up striking out and ends the game.
I always find it hard to critique players for not allowing the baseball to hit them. The baseball really hurts when it hits you. Even on a breaking ball, especially at your legs. That being said, if we're going to be the average Joes, right? If the Brewers are going
this
to play
the, point. The this character, is correct.
Like the grit monster, if you're going to be the grit monster, you can't dodge this. You just can't. Like, and if I feel stupid to be like, how did Terang do this? The answer is, you know, 15 years of natural reaction and muscle memory to playing baseball, and humans want to get out of the way of things that are thrown at them, right? But you could train that out, you know. Over time, like, we know there's a Division III baseball team that won a national championship because they taught all their players to never move out of the way of the ball, and they broke their hit by pitch records. Okay, now very different circumstance, I'm aware. But it is just funny that the most college baseball team in the major leagues, managed by a former college coach, is the one that gets out of the way in the situation. Also funny because Bryce Terang drafted out of high school.
No, I mean, that was literally my first thought when this happened, was like, ooh, Terang didn't go to college. Like, he...
Like, Frelick.
Did not Frelick have... Oh, for sure.
Boston College?
Yeah. Yeah. That
Caleb Durbin?
The grind of... Oh, my God. Of course. So, yeah. Now, listen. I maintain, you know, what you said, and even Murph said postgame, like, it's a human thing. Like, it's not that simple. You can't just stand in there. But you can just stand in there if you are more conditioned to do it. Now, the extreme end of the spectrum is the Misericordia Cougars, who, we shall say, that's not the only reason they won the national championship, but it certainly helped. but
okay,
but
no, yes.
I mean, they're pretty
that's
good
the headline.
At baseball anyway.
That's the headline.
It is certainly the headline. It is really the headline. Anyway, the point is, yes, you can definitely condition yourself to not get out of the way, and that has not been the case for Bryce Durang in his career, and that's fine, it's whatever. But in this case, highly unfortunate, because the Dodgers end up getting away with another bullpen near meltdown and taking that first game, and then cruising into game two and just riding the wave of what appears to be the best starting pitching we've seen in quite some time. Here is a ridiculous statistic as we wrap up this segment. Dodgers starters over their last 30 games dating back to the regular season. This is from Optostats. 15-1, 1.49 ERA, 1.44 opponent's batting average, 0.81 whip, 214 strikeouts. Wow. I mean, I think what makes this so fun is that because the bullpen is what it is, we are going to be treated to these Dodgers starters being pushed farther than maybe they normally would. Now, they are earning it because they are this good and they are pitching this well. But I love that we're going to get to watch it even more than we probably would have normally, because Dave Roberts is going to be terrified to call down to the bullpen in almost any scenario. So we're going to have Glasnow in game three as they go back to LA, Ohtani in game four. And it's just, it's an unbelievable collection of talented pitchers and performing at their best when the Dodgers need them the most.
Yep. I have one stat that bums me out that I'd like to share.
Sure.
Christian Yelich does not have a postseason RBI since game 7 of the 2018 NLCS, okay, against the Dodgers. He homered in the bottom of the first inning of that game to give the Brewers a 1-0 lead.
This can't be right. This sounds impossibly wrong.
Christian Yelich does not have a postseason RBI since game 7 of the 2018 NLCS. He has, in that time, played 15 playoff games. Okay. Two games in 20, 4 in 21, 2 in 23, 7 thus far in 25. He was hurt last year. But he does not have a postseason RBI since game 7 of the 2018 NLCS. Now, that says, you know, he hasn't been awful. He's got a couple three-hit games in there. He has not gone yard. It says just as much in my mind about the Brewers' offense and an inability to, like, get guys on as it does about Yelich. But to me, that's it, right? Like, the Brewers are being baffled here by the Dodger pitching. And their best players, like, maybe are just not good enough to hit against this Dodger group. Now, I could be wrong.
Well, and
maybe.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, this was the other point I was going to make earlier when you referenced, you know, what they've done in this series compared to before. I think, and what I'm about to say is obviously very disrespectful to the Cubs, but sorry, their season's over. we didn't exactly, like, build our way up to the Dodgers, you know, for the Brewers in terms of, like, what they were facing. From a pitching perspective, like, the Cubs have some guys, but that was not like, okay, we're going to face this, and then we're going to face this, and then we're going to face this, and now we get to the Dodgers. It was kind of like, all right, we're going to face a solid team, and now we're just going straight to the best starting pitching that the game has had in a long time.
Colin Ray to Blake Snell. Like, you know, when I was in New York City, I would go to Planet Fitness. This was my gym, no free ads. And like at my Planet Fitness, often, you know, if you go to lift some weights, they every weight is not always available because it is, you know, it is sometimes a mess at that Planet Fitness. And so like if you're gonna bet, if you're benching, doing bench press, and like the 30s are there, and then there's nothing, and you're warming up, and there's nothing until the 55s, like you just gotta go, like that's it. Like you are you just gotta go to the 55s. And you know, it's can be a little bit humbling when you try to make that leap. And that's the Milwaukee Brewers will head out west with a 2-0 deficit to try. At this point, the narrative for them is simple. One more home game. Just send it back home. Now, that is easier said than done. Much easier said than done. Because you got to win twice in Chavez Ravine. We can have longer, more grandiose discussions about the Dodger dominance later this week when they inevitably, it feels, win this NLCS and reach the World Series for the second consecutive year. Anything else on this set before we take a break and move to the American League?
No, sir. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Talk about the Mariners and Blue Jays.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. My dear friend and co-host, Jordan Schusterman, is currently in Seattle, Washington. He is not there to fish or to go up the Space Needle or to climb Mount Rainier, which is actually something I would love to do. He is there because the Seattle Mariners are in the American League Championship Series. And not only are the Seattle Mariners in the American League Championship Series, they are up a commanding 2-0 over the Toronto Blue Jays. Much like the National League side, the road team secured both games in the opponent's ballpark to start this series. That has to be pretty rare. Someone call Sarah Langs. Mariners, we talked after game one of this set, which the M's won 3-1 behind a great pitching performance from Bryce Miller, a solo shot from Cal Raleigh. We have not talked since game two, a 10-3 drubbing for the M's over the Jays. Why don't you take the beat by beat here?
Yeah, I might just toss it back to you here because I'll be honest, I went out to dinner. I treated this like a regular season deal. Just check the phone. Oh, Mariners are up 10-3. All right, cool, whatever.
You're like, cool, the Mariners are up 10-3 in the playoffs. Yeah, that's pretty sweet. Come on now.
Moving on. I will just quickly say, before I throw it back to you for the play-by-play, I mean, I obviously know what happened in this game, but since you were there, I feel like you're still in a better position to do it. Sarah Langs obviously got you covered. Only the second time that this has happened. Where both
amazing.
Are you kidding? Only the second time that both LCSs were started by 2-0 leads by the road team, and the first time since 1970. Oh my goodness! So this is a very 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 rare occurrence, and we'll see how this goes. But anyway, back to game two. We have I'll tee it up at least here from the standpoint of. I was fascinated and curious and excited about this pitching matchup, which was Trey Savage against Logan Gilbert, right? Gilbert had pitched twice since Savage had last pitched. Savage was amazing against the Yankees. We talked about on the pod, how would the rookie handle this environment where there's already some pressure, they're down in the series. And when Julio Rodriguez hits a 3-run homer in the top of the first, you're just like, oh, okay, well, that's not looking great for the old Jays of Toronto.
I think it was more than, obviously a 3-run homer is important, but it was more than that. It was that it went walk homer. Because if Trey Savage was going to struggle, that is how he was going to struggle. It was going to be fastball command. It was going to be walks. It was going to be traffic on the bases. And it was going to be the Mariners taking advantage of having guys on. And that happens before there's an out, right? Randy walk. Cal walk, Julio 3-run laser beam.
Randy hit by pitch,
Hit by pitch.
Doug Eddings screws up. And spoiler alert, Doug Eddings is not a good umpire. He has not been a good umpire for a long time. He was screwing stuff up on both sides. That's all we have to say about that.
the Jays did not lose this game because of the umpiring. If that is going to make people feel like, if you want to be mad at the umpires because your team lost, like, that's fine. Like, whatever you need to do to sleep at night. But in reality, like, yes, that was a big call in the first inning. I do not think you can hinge the entire game on that. I don't think the Jays feel that way. I'll tell you that much. So Julio goes bridge in the bottom of the, excuse me, the top of the first. From where the press box is at the at Rogers Center down the left field line, you can't see the bottom of the foul pole because they did all these renovations. Mm. They moved the press box from behind home plate. So, like, we had no idea. Like, we couldn't really track the ball, and it just, like, disappears beneath you. And then you're going off of the Mariners' dugout reaction. So they go up 3-0. Mm-hmm. Jays bounce back in the bottom of the first, scoring two runs. Gilbert looks shaky. And then they put it into cruise control, managing just one more hit after the second inning. Jays tied up in that second inning, make it 3-3. One more hit over the final seven. And the Mariners do the dang thing. Jorge Polanco, this October's improbable, inevitable hero, as I wrote in my game story, three-run jack to blow it open off Louis Varland after Yusavage gets yanked. Josh Naylor has a three-run home run of his own. And that was it. That was this game. Three-run homers for the Mariners. They add another run. Win 10-3. Before this game, I picked the Mariners. You know, like, you're hanging around the yard and people are like, who you got tonight? I picked the Mariners. And my reasoning was, I thought Gilbert was going to give more length, provide more length than Yusavage. And I was wrong about that. Gilbert only lasts three innings. Yusavage, I think, works into the fourth or the fifth. But my thought process was, I do not really still trust the second-tier relievers that the Jays have. And I do trust the second-tier relievers that the Mariners have. And that was the story of this game. That you have the B-team Mariners relievers going out there and throwing six scoreless innings, right? This was not Gabe Spire to Matt Brash to Andres Munoz. I know that the guys who pitched are also good. And my point is, for Edward Bizardo, Carlos Vargas, and Emerson Hancock to throw six scoreless innings, that is, like, it perfectly exemplifies what the Mariners do well, right? They're pitching dev and getting the most out of players like this so that they can throw three dudes who were less famous than Humpy for six innings scoreless in a playoff game. Like, that's the whole thing. So that's my wrap up of game two. Curious for your perspective as someone who was eating dinner during the game.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I've been tweeting out all kinds of things about how awesome Edward Bizardo is in support of him being in that A tier. But the truth is also that he also basically pitches in every game. So it's kind of hard to tell what his leverage role is, because even in this one, he goes another, you know, two scoreless, and clearly he has worked his way to the top. But no, Vargas and Hancock for sure. I mean, the fact that those guys, now they were able to pitch with a pretty sizable lead, but the fact that Varland, Fluharty, Fisher, Rodriguez all allowed runs in this game. I mean, that's not going to cut it. That's not, you're just not giving yourself a chance. Now, your hitters aren't really giving yourself a chance either. To have one hit in the final seven innings after having two hits in game one, I mean, this is just, it's just not good enough. And you can credit the Mariners pitchers all you want, but this is the offense that absolutely, you know, smacked the Yankees around. And so baseball's weird like that. We're dealing with small samples on both sides, but it has just been an objectively disappointing showing from this group. I, as much as I believe that the Mariners pitching is better and clearly has proven that over the previous series as well, I thought Toronto at home would be putting up more of a fight at this point. And as the series shifts to Seattle, it's not like runs are suddenly going to become easier to come by. I mean, all three of the games against Detroit at T-Mobile Park finished with the final score of 3-2, and we know one of those games went 15 innings. So, I mean, maybe Toronto shows up and they're playing loose, and I'm sure they'll say, all right, well, what do we got to lose? You know, okay, whatever. Now we can just relax and do our thing. And maybe that's true. Maybe they go out and blast George Kirby and Luis Castillo and get back in the series. It's possible they have a lot of talented hitters. But I think that's what I'm thinking about as the series shifts here is, obviously, can the Mariners just stay this much in command? And how do the offenses perform in Seattle? Because the Mariners haven't exactly been crushing the ball at home either. It's been more timely hits than anything than actual like offensive barrages that we saw in this game and you know earlier in the series against Detroit in that game three. So they have that ability, but at home it's still been a struggle. So that's what's most terrifying. On top of the fact that the pitching matchups still pretty much favor Seattle because you have George Kirby against Shane Bieber in game three, and you have Luis Castillo against Max Scherzer, who had an ERA over 10 in September.
So that's the thing.
Will be making his Blue Jays postseason debut here in game four.
So the Mariners have a 2-0 lead in the series. They also now, I think, roll into the part of this ALCS where they have the biggest advantage, which is pitching depth. Like, I know Shane Bieber is Shane Bieber, but, you know, based upon how he looked against the Yankees in that game three, I'll take George Kirby, right? I would say. And then you have Castillo against Scherzer. And then you have just Brian Wu waiting in the wings, who might not even have to pitch in this series. You know, like this, the series goes along and pitching depth becomes more important, the Mariners are only going to gain more of an advantage because I feel better about all the arms that they have from top to bottom. Now, what I wrote after the game, game two, is, and you can, you know, as somebody who cares about the Mariners, it all feels really easy right now in this way. Like, game two was painless, stress-free, relatively. And I'm sure there is a part of the Mariner fan psyche that's like, okay, when's the other shoe going to drop? Like, how is this going to go wrong? And it, you know, going home up 2-0 does kind of set the stage for some, like, could be really embarrassing. But I just get the sense that you and your people are living in uncharted territory. And it is just, I just get glee. I just get like total joy.
Yeah, I mean, they look like the better team and they're playing like it. But to your point, like I definitely got too comfortable and assumed that it was over in the beginning of game four against Detroit. I watched them kick the crap out of them in game three. They're up 3-0 through four innings and then everything changed because the playoffs are weird. So we'll see how these games in Seattle go. They, as I just said, and as you just very reasonably laid out, they clearly have the advantage on the mound and just how these pitchers are performing. The fact that now, you know, Spire and Munoz and Brash got a couple days off. Like, you know, there's just a lot of things tilting in Seattle's favor. But we've seen weird stuff happen. And as Mitch Garver rightly pointed out, he just did this with the Rangers where they went up 2-0 in Houston in the CS 2 years ago and then lost all three games at home. We know they, of course, end up winning that series. But it's, you know, weird things happen here in the postseason. So big spot for Shane Bieber, especially how disappointing that spot was against that appearance was against the Yankees. Scherzer is going to be his own conversation that I can't even like fully process yet. So I'm just going to kind of table that one for now. I'm certainly looking forward to talk about him, whether that goes incredibly well or incredibly terribly. And yeah, man, I mean, they have never gotten this far. They have never won a third game in the CS ever. And we know they've never been to the World Series. So the next win will be the farthest they have ever gotten as a franchise in nearly 50 years, right? So that is what is kind of at stake here. And I will be, of course, in the building. Very excited to be back here in Seattle for the first time since the All-Star game in 23. And we will see how this goes.
Before we take a break, I would just like to direct people to the story I wrote that is up on the website today.
Please do.
At Yahoo about Humpy. the Mariners salmon mascot. We chatted about Humpy on our last episode, but over the last, 72 hours, we have really dug deep into Humpy lore. This story covers the origins of Humpy, the ethos of Humpy, the mastermind of Humpy, everything you could ever want to know and more about the bumbling, clumsy, slow Mariners mascot race, winless fish, and how that winless fish legitimately helped energize the ballpark in the 15th inning. This story was an absolute delight to work on. And talked to the director of game entertainment with the Mariners, who, helped make the call about Humpy. And now we're in a place where, like, okay, so what do they do with Humpy? What happens in game three with Humpy? It's a fascinating thing, right?
Trust me. This is very high on the list of things I'm excited about tonight. It's just what happens next. And I don't know. There's part of me, I think the obvious answer is he just wins until the Mariners lose.
I think you have to do that.
I think that's probably right. What would be the funniest thing if he just literally just demolishes everybody?
That's what I was going to say. That's what I, yeah. If I was in that chair, okay, if I was in that chair, I think that's what I would do. They all go out there, on your mark, get set, go, and it's just like Humpy by yards, by leagues and leagues, yeah. Right?
Yeah, you hire an Olympic sprinter to sub in as Humpy, and it's just like an absolute just blowout.
This is that who we are now. Yeah. This is who we are as a franchise now, okay? That's what we do.
We win. We don't lose.
We win.
So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I will certainly report back when we
record
next.
This.
All right. Yes, I will. I will be.
Because it's not on the broadcast.
Don't you worry.
Yeah. Okay.
That's true. I will put
you and 45,000 other people will be filming.
If I didn't, I'm pretty sure people will be posting videos. I think it'll be covered. I am not too concerned about that. Although honestly, if you're the Fox broadcast, you probably got to show it. Not you're not getting
in the same way that like when they were showing John Duran's walkout entrance on the Phillies broadcast.
Again, there's in the postseason broadcast, you're not going to not run the commercials. I'm just saying that you got to be filming it so that if something notable happens, you can show it when you come back from break and make John Smoltz talk about it. Make John Smoltz talk about Humpy. That should be the goal of the Fox broadcast in game three. All right, we're gonna take a break. When we return, we're gonna talk about non-postseason topics, at least for a couple minutes before we say goodbye. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We understand the postseason is going, but the other teams are just doing so much stuff, particularly with non-players, and we need to review some of it. Let's go around the league. Let's talk about who's not going. All right. Rob Thompson is not going. The Phillies manager, who was criticized during the team's NLDS for some questionable decisions, most notably his choice to have Bryson Stott bunt in game two. He is not leaving. He is under contract through next year. What is compelling about this is often you see teams with managers on a hot seat give them an additional year so that they don't feel like a lame duck, right? Where it's not something that they need to be asked about all year long. We saw this with Ollie Marmol. We even saw this with Mike Schilt, who we'll talk about in a second, right? They give them the extension even if they don't plan on keeping them. That's not the case here, it seems. Thompson is a managerial free agent at the end of this year. He's going to still be there next year. I think this is notable because to me, it's actually a sign that they might make more changes to the roster than we anticipated, because if you make a bunch of changes to the roster, maybe you want some continuity in the big chair to help with that. I don't know. We'll see. It is interesting because I had heard that there was a legitimate conversation about this, right? It was not a foregone conclusion that Thompson would be back in Philly, but he is, and we'll see how things pan out there.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously have a better sense for the Phillies than I do. I think from my perspective, I just assume he'd be gone because everyone's gone. And like this offseason so far has just been defined by managerial turnover, and we haven't even seen who the new managers are yet. But as we move on to our next topic, which is Mike Schilt retiring and deciding I'm done, deciding I don't want to do this anymore because this is a stressful, unpleasant job. And of course, he talked very honestly about some of the challenges of that involving, you know, unfortunately, this has just become a thing we're talking about often, which is players and managers and people in the sport getting death threats because people are gambling their money and aren't happy. It's obviously a very troubling trend that we will have to keep talking about.
Yeah. Seems okay. Everything seems great.
That's bad. But, you know, there's other parts about this job that are, of course, stressful and unpleasant. Particularly, I imagine, for a team like the Padres that has had a lot happen to it over the last few years, some of their control, some of not. And Mike Schilt, who's, of course, lived a baseball life, deciding he's done. But this is pretty surprising because it seemed like he probably could have stuck around there if not. Now, I understand people are reading into this and be like, this something doesn't add up. Maybe they did want to move on to him and they just decided mutually to part ways, as we've seen with some of these other situations where it's like, okay, they're saying it's mutual, but maybe they wanted to move on anyway. Regardless of how we ended up here, here we are with eight managerial openings, and it would have been nine if the Rangers hadn't hired Skip Schumacher immediately, which we haven't even talked about on this show because we kind of assumed it was going to happen and we didn't really have much to add. We don't have to dig in on Skip right now, but again, this is an unbelievable amount of turnover to have, you know, a third of the league changing over its manager. And it's so much more than that because, you know, we also get news this week that the Mets hired a new bench coach that we're quite familiar with, our good pal Kai Correa, who has been the director of many things for the Cleveland Guardians over the last two seasons.
This.
I mean, we can talk about Kai. Go ahead.
So one nerdy thing that Jordan and I keep track of is like all of the different roles that these teams give their guys. Mm-hmm. Kai Correa, I mean this, had the single longest title of any major league coach. He was the Guardians' major league field coordinator and director of defense, base running, and game strategy. That was hit, like that's on the business card. I assume that during the introductions before game one of the wild card, they said, and here's the yabba dabba 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 doo, Kai Correa.
I see. Now I super regret not paying attention to that. It's amazing he could be in charge of all those things and still have any time to talk to me. But Kai was very, very friendly during his time in Cleveland. Obviously, rose up through the D3 legend. Truly. And I mean, again, I'll say it. He's you know, someone that we believe in all of his various roles, and we're excited to see what happens next with him. And this is certainly quite the step up to become the bench coach for the New York Mets, which is really cool. But I bring that up not just to say nice things about Kai, which we could do, but more that just like a reminder that this is so much more than these eight, or I guess nine, absolutely, managerial spots. This is going to impact so many teams.
So many teams. Because you have all of the managers moving, but then these managers are going to bring people with them. And this, Kai going from Cleveland to New York is not even an example of that, because Vogt's staying in Cleveland and Mendoza's staying in New York. But when, you know, let's just say, you know, Louis Rojas interviewed for the Orioles job. If Louis Rojas takes the Orioles job, he might take someone on the Yankees staff with him. He'll probably like call someone that he coached with 13 years ago who might be on the Reds staff. Like, there's just going to be so much movement here this year. And it's important because these are the people actually doing the coaching. the manager is a manager, right? They are not as involved in the physical development of players anymore. Some of them are in certain aspects, and it's still important. It's a different job. The rest of the staff is who's doing, like, getting hands-on and doing the nitty-gritty and helping players get better. And I think it will be super interesting to see where all the chips fall at the end of the year. And it is definitely something that you and I are keeping an eye on.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating thing. And yeah, as you mentioned, right, it's going to impact the teams that are already in good shape with their coaching staffs and their managers who are locked in. Now, I will, the last point I'll make about this, there are very clear rules in place about how many people you can realistically poach and or ask about in an interview. And so you can't just have one guy bringing his whole staff the way you would see in like college baseball, where like Chris Pollard left Duke to go to Virginia and essentially took everybody with him, including, you know, several players, or same thing with, you know, Brian O'Connor from Virginia to Mississippi State. In college baseball, in college, my understanding in college sports, this happens all the time. In the big leagues, it's not that simple. You can't just take everybody with you, but it is a part. It is a process, and it's not the way I really learned about that is actually was a year ago when the Marlins hired Clayton McCullough. That new staff was just like one guy from like 12 different teams. And it was a fascinating mix. And I was like, this is an amazingly diverse thing. And then someone told me like, yeah, because they're not allowed to just take everybody from the Dodgers, or they're not allowed to just take everybody from the same place. Right. And so you're going to see these places with new managers. You know, this Kai Correa example is someone, he's joining a staff that is obviously also being kind of revamped this offseason for the Mets. You're going to see these new managers, whether it's in Atlanta or San Francisco or Washington or Baltimore, just kind of pluck from around the league. And then that's where that network kind of comes in. And like you said, it's going to be really fascinating.
It's fascinating. It's just like, how does that dude know anybody from this staff, right? It's like, what's the connection there? Because reputation goes a long way, but it's not like a player where you can look at the numbers and be like, oh, well, that guy can hit. You know what I mean? Like the Guardians, there's a point. Like Kai has a track record of making defenders better, and you could see that in Cleveland, right? But that is not as obvious all the time with every single dude, right? Well, okay, so like David Popkins, who is the Jays hitting coach, who got like the biggest crowd pop besides Vladdy before game one, who has like revolutionized the Jays big league hitting coaching staff and like rejuvenated George Springer. Like he was in Minnesota who couldn't hit, right? And now the results don't always tell the whole story, I guess is my point. Speaking of results telling the whole story, the New York Yankees.
I'm sorry. I like David Popkins. I interviewed him this year. The hitting coach getting a standing ovation, which has maybe never happened ever, and then the Blue Jays doing what they did in the first two games is like the perfect encapsulation of all of this.
Right. Also, shouts out to Jays fans. Like, that's a ball knowers crowd move. Absolutely. Standing O for the hitting coach. I mean, I remember earlier this year when Brian Roberts on the Orioles broadcast was like, Jays fans, Canadians don't know ball. This single act of the hitting coach standing O. I mean, I disagreed with what Roberts said already, but watching like 30,000 of the 44,000 rise to their feet for David Popkins was a great reminder that the Jays fans do, in fact, know ball. The last nugget here is the Yankees let go of two of their coaches, Mike Harkey, who's the bullpen coach who'd been there for a long time in two different stints, and then Travis Chapman, who was in charge of defense and specifically infield. That feels interesting. That's interesting. Was around Travis Chapman, didn't really know him too well. But the Yankees infield defense, particularly as it pertains to Anthony Volpe, was a big topic of conversation this year. It'll be very compelling to see who the Yankees hire to fill that role. All we know is they can have a beard now. Let's get out of here. We've gone too long. Tonight is Dominican Winter League opening day.
Yes.
What a gift.
Oh my gosh. I can't wait. I've got my Escogido hat on. It's the only hat I brought on this trip. And we will see how they defend their title. The only thing I can say for sure about Escogido this season is that Junior Caminero will not be playing. he has done his time. He has won his championship. And now he can relax. But I am so excited to be watching some winter ball and know that that is waiting for us when this MLB postseason comes to an end. But also, I'll be watching over the next couple weeks as well. Thank you to Andrew Hartz, Ingrid Rosas for producing. As always, thank you, Jake Mintz, for making this podcast with me. I appreciate it. If you see me in Seattle, say hello. And we'll see how this goes. We are planning to record right now on Thursday evening after those two games. So we'll see what we're talking about. But until then, enjoy the baseball. You can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you soon.